Hello, I'm Angela Barnes, and I've just snuck on here to tell you that We Are History, the Less Than Serious podcast hosted by me and John O'Farrell, has joined the Podmasters gang. And this is great news for us, because not only are Podmasters purveyors of excellent podcasts, but neither John or I have ever been in a gang before, so we're obviously thrilled to bits. We Are History's seventh series will be launching very soon, but if you can't wait, you can listen right now to our entire back catalogue of 80 or so eclectic episodes. We bring you the most interesting stories we can find from the past, so have a listen if you'd like to know whether Vlad the Impaler's anger issues really earned him that nickname, or how a notorious family from Essex ended up declaring an independent country on a platform in the North Sea. Or maybe how a dead homeless Welshman changed Britain's fortunes in World War II. So that's We Are History. It might not change the world as much as the Black Death did, but it is a little bit funnier. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Start Your Week. I'm Jacob the First, newly crowned King of the Bunker. Here with me today is one of our dear and loyal subjects, Hannah Fern. Good morning, Hannah. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I don't know how I feel about being your subject, mate.
Just, you know, you'll get used to it, just as we'll all get used to Charles, I'm sure. He's he's great. Hannah, although I just did it, I'm almost bored of taking the piss out of the coronation, which is a strange feeling because I do love taking the piss out of stuff. Is it finally nearly over? Do I not need to hear any more about this anymore?
God, I hope so. The bunting feels like it's going to be gone by the end of today, surely. People will be taking it down. I'm definitely over it. I only managed about 2 hours of the main event on Saturday, and I only really watched it because I wanted to show my children it, because it felt kind of historically important, if utterly tedious. The weather didn't help, and the turnout, interestingly, wasn't what people were expecting, even along the kind of main route, which I read was shortened because turnout was less than had been previous. Yeah, exactly. And even then, when they were cramming people in, it was only a few rows deep rather than the kind of huge crowds that we used to see for the Queen.
Yeah, God knows. I mean, if we can make the special relationship back to being a little bit special, that wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing, but who knows. On things that stood out to me, how do you feel about the idea of Prime Minister Penny Mordaunt after she got so much praise for being very, very good at holding that massive sword that she had to hold?
Do you know what it reminded me of? Eddie Izzard, the comedian, used to do a stand-up joke in the 1990s about Americans singing the national anthem. And in that gag, there was a reflection on the fact that 70% of what people react to when they see someone speaking or singing the national anthem or whatever in public is how they look. And only 20% is how you sound and 10% is what you say. So the truth is, you know, she did look great. This is why I think fashion does matter, when people question if fashion's a load of old nonsense. This kind of thing, she picked a banging outfit, looked like a real statesperson. And so that's something we've obviously lacked for a while. And, you know, even Starmer, we've got to call him government in waiting or whatever, he has his moments of lacking statespersonliness as well. So, obviously, it's very easy to look like a statesperson when you literally don't have to say anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's not coming from nowhere. She was the opponent that Labour really feared when they were re-electing a leader. So the sort of meaningless, but I suppose generally positive reaction that people had to her means that she almost certainly is the next Tory leader, I would say, which is a weird thing after just carrying a sword.
I'd quite like to see her and Starmer sort of trying to one-up each other in more and more garishly ludicrous outfits. Just gold on top of gold on top of gold, sort of everyone looking like David Bowie for a little bit would be quite something. It would stop the whole boring Starmer narrative.
It would cheer everything up a bit.
Obviously, there's been this sort of side of the coronation which has been very tedious and, you know, something to poke fun at, but there was a serious aspect over the weekend of the arrests of protesters, which, in a word, was grim, really. Can the Met just ride this out?
It really feels like the Met are just trying to sort of create enemies in as many corners of society as possible. It's just an example of what a dysfunctional and sort of hateful organisation it is. Can it ride it out? It's an interesting thing. This was the first test of the new legislation around protest. And I know there's still an investigation going on, so we have to be careful what we say, but it does look like the classic approach of use the legislation to lock up first, avoid a situation, and then sort of ask questions and release people who are completely innocent later. So that is not democratic policing. It looked really, really un-British, I think, on a what you might describe as sort of a quintessentially British weekend. They are trying to ride it out. The defence, I don't know if you spotted this, the defence that they used was that everything passed off smoothly. So, I mean, that's really frightening. That's sort of pure totalitarianism. Yeah. And actually, that isn't coming from government, though the legislation is awful, but from the police themselves. So I guess it's up to all of us whether we just let that slide.
Yeah, this kind of utilitarian approach to policing that they're going, oh, well, it was for the greater good, actually doesn't really fill me with any variety of confidence whatsoever to say, oh, well, yeah, so those people suffered from that potentially, but it was for the good of everyone else who was there. That's, to me, not really a way that the law should be doled out.
No, that's not their purpose at all. You know, their purpose is to make sure that the law is enacted, but in a fair and just way. And that is not fair and just.
Is there any chance of a full-on inquiry into this, or do you think it's going to get swept under the rug?
I think it will get swept, to be honest, because people are going to move on. There's so much going on in the next few weeks in Westminster. There are a lot of excuses for the government to use to just kind of sweep over it. The interesting thing is, if the Met continue making public errors, you know, it might be more difficult for the government to get away with that.
Should we look to see that the government might change its mind in any way on these protest laws, or is this going to entrench positions, basically? Because as you say there, the police's logic of saying it passed off smoothly would appear to me to be, well, then the government is going to say these laws did what they were meant to,
and
collateral damage and anything.
I think, I really very sadly sort of think and suspect that it will entrench positions, because this sort of nothing occurred defence isn't as unpopular as I would wish. People do think that practicalities are not the bigger picture matter. And I think it's really similar to terror legislation in that sense. We, the public, let all kinds of horrors through on terror legislation because of this argument that the bigger picture matters more than the way we, you know, enact the law. But what's lost just to have the coronation go off without a hitch? That's the question I'd urge people to ask themselves.
Yeah. I saw on Facebook over the weekend a sort of bit of arguing between, you know, random family members, as you see,
and
someone just said about some protests have been arrested, and I saw another family member comment saying, well, you know, does that really fill you with any confidence that they can't protest against this? And they said, oh, well, you know, they were making a nuisance of themselves, they were outnumbered, and so the police just didn't really have very much choice. And I was like, what? So you're saying there wasn't very many of them and they were just being annoying?
Yeah, I mean, that threshold is so low now. The threshold is basically being slightly irritating, which is that's not democracy. The right to irritate is surely something we should stand up for.
So moving on, last week, the local elections were worse than the Tories' damage control briefings even suggested they might be. You know, we might lose 1,000 seats and then doing it seems to me to be quite embarrassing, really. How are we going to see parties manoeuvre now moving forward?
I think the thing to remember about the local elections is it is exciting if you're, you know, a Labour voter or centre-left leaning to see this, but they're only an indicator of feeling. They're not actually in any way an accurate reflection of voting intention. Obviously, you see the success of minority parties and independents and so on. So, you know, in terms of how they're manoeuvring, actually, this is even worse for the Tories when full tactical voting comes into play. So they're going to have to avoid that wherever possible and really focus their efforts on, you know, Lib Dem risk seats. That sort of bring back Boris thing, which began to emerge in the immediate aftermath, I think that could have troubled Sunak for longer, but it didn't, because the coronation sort of ended that conversation before it even got going. So that, I think Sunak's very lucky that happened, and he won't have to contend with that bit of manoeuvring as well, personally. Labour are obviously going to be looking at areas where they expected a higher swing and didn't get. So the councils, there are quite a few councils that are now in no overall control, instead of perhaps a return to full Labour control, which they might have hoped for. Some of those in the whether we call it Blue Wall, Red Wall, I don't know what we call it these days, but up, you know, in that area of the country. So that's probably going to be their focus, I would say.
With this talk of hung parliament in the air, are the Lib Dems and Greens going to start flexing some muscle, or would that be very ambitious? I've seen quite a lot of news stories just with Ed Davey as the focus.
Yeah, he's everywhere, isn't he?
Yeah, which
Ed
you don't normally see. Yeah, exactly. And it sort of, to me, seems like that would be, he's not the most exciting
rent-a-quote. Oh, poor old Ed Davey. I think he's a very honest, decent chap that doesn't, he's boring, so again, so he doesn't really get the airtime. I think they will try and use this, and I do think that's a little bit behind the kind of Ed Davey says news coverage at the moment. It's also due to the fact that news organisations are listening to them again because they are starting to have some kind of political influence. But it is all quite meaningless until you're actually in a negotiating room post hung parliament. And I don't think there will be a hung parliament, actually. But even if there was, I find everything in the run-up really, I know there'll be backroom conversations that we're not party to, but all the stuff in the press, which is from Labour saying we definitely won't have any, you know, formal agreement with the Lib Dems if it means keeping the Tories out, you know, of course you have to vote Labour, there's no alternative. That's nonsense. If there was an actual hung parliament, of course there would be a Labour-Lib Dem coalition, of course. We aren't stupid. Voters aren't daft. We know, you know, keeping the Tories out is a priority to both those parties. And we know that the Lib Dems will never again agree to any kind of formal relationship with the Conservatives because they were so badly burned by it last time. So, yeah, it makes sense to shore up the progressive vote, I guess, by flexing those muscles a little bit, making it look like you're ready to work with Labour. I think that's all we can say about that.
Parliament is returning this week. What are you keeping an eye on?
There's so much going on at the moment. Obviously, immediately tomorrow, there's Sunak's first PMQ since the local elections, and you can kind of expect him to meet a very emboldened Starmer. So I think that's definitely worth watching. In terms of legislation, there is the Levelling Up Bill, the Online Safety Bill, and the illegal migration measures are all in the Lords. So they're all controversial, all likely have significant amendments placed by the Lords. So that's definitely one to watch. And then in the Commons, the Tories are likely to throw out changes already tabled by the Lords to the Energy Bill. And those amends were about requiring a ban on new coal mines, which the Conservative majority is likely to chuck out. How depressing is that? You know, that seems the simplest measure that you can put in an energy bill at the moment to really make sure we're heading towards 2050, but apparently not. So that might probably go back and forth for a while. But the really big one that nobody who's heard me regularly on the pod will be surprised here is that I'm very excited to see that the Renters Reform Bill will finally be published this week. This has been anticipated for years and campaigned on for, I would say, decades, to be honest. And it's basically legislation that beefs up tenants' rights, including getting rid of so-called no-fault eviction, where somebody might make a request to their landlord for a repair, a very basic repair, could actually be quite a significant repair, like a major leak in your shower or something, and then find that they are told to, they have, you know, a few weeks to leave because the landlord doesn't want to bother paying any money to repair. So these are very small concessions to even out the kind of power relationship between renters and landlords.
Suella Braverman is back facing criticism, as she always seems to be at the moment. The Home Office is under fire over how it's handling Sudanese refugees. What's going on there, Hannah?
So it's accused of racism, basically, saying that the there's a kind of categorisation of need between Sudanese refugees and Ukrainian refugees, with those from Sudan treated very differently to those who are arriving from war-torn Ukraine. Of course, there are no kind of safe and legal routes for Sudanese to come through, particularly for unaccompanied Sudanese children as well, which is really hard to think about. But actually, it is blown up now, I think, because people have really got their eye on Braverman and the Home Office. But this is not unusual. And if you talk to anyone who's handled the situation with housing Afghan refugees here, it's been the same for them, the same for Syrians. You know, Ukraine was treated differently. Ukraine was allowed homestays and that whole project to make sure that there was a home for every Ukrainian who came to the UK. You know, Homes for Ukraine was a huge government-backed project. Campaigners working with Afghans and Syrians both tried to get something similar off the ground for them, and it was categorically refused. So there is evidence that there has been a very different attitude towards Ukrainian refugees to those fleeing other conflicts. And it doesn't take a long leap to suggest there's some kind of, you know, systemic racism involved.
Is it just, you know, obviously basically a failing department here as well, though, that we're seeing? I mean, more widely, removed from this specific even, it would seem to me the Home Office is just failing on every single front, isn't it?
I mean, I do think there's kind of two questions. There's the bigger question of the Home Office isn't working well at all, and to use that horrible old phrase, not fit for purpose. I mean, it hasn't been for a long time. It does need reform, and it does need sort of potentially breaking up into different sections. But I do think there is more to it than that. And I don't know whether I go so far as to use the word racism as those who are speaking out about this are, but there's definitely been a kind of willingness and enthusiasm around housing white Ukrainians that there hasn't been put into other rescue efforts. Certainly once people are arrived here, there's been a very different attitude and a very different management process for Ukrainians than others. So that, I mean, we should ask those legitimate questions about that.
Finally, on domestic stuff, in Broken Britain Watch at the moment, what is going on with pharmacies and pharmacies apparently just being something that can replace GPs, apparently?
Now, this is my favourite story of the weekend in terms of inept government. So the latest sort of prong in government's attempt to claim that it is going to be the saviour rather than, in fact, as it is, the destroyer of our NHS, is a plan to take the pressure off GPs by using the skills and, you know, accessibility of pharmacies. Great idea. Brilliant idea. Loads of people go to the GP when they don't need to. Pharmacists have got loads of knowledge that they could share. And, you know, brilliant way to spread the burden. However, we've got the lowest number of pharmacies in England since 2015, which is, of course, since we had a Conservative government. More than 400 have closed in the last year. So how's that going to work? This is just classic nonsense, again, where it sounds great and it is a good idea, but if you look at the practicalities, it doesn't stack up. It's very frustrating. And you know, actually, to be fair to those who want to point this out, not enough of the news coverage made that distinction this weekend. So the Tories got a load of free coverage about how their great plan without anyone querying how that would actually work, apart from the odd outlet. So, you know, people are left with an unfairly positive perspective on this. And that's frustrating.
Yeah. Moving away from Britain, the Texas mall shooting over the weekend was another horrific act of gun violence in America, which just feels like a sentence we can say
every few days
at the moment, which is, you know, never less depressing, really. What's going on with the investigation into this specific instance?
So there was a 33-year-old guy, the male attacker, who was shot and killed at the scene. So he's not going to face justice for the 8 people he killed and 7 he wounded. But the investigation into him and sort of his motivation has potentially identified far-right extremist ideology. Again, that's obviously a really hard issue for the right-wing pro-gun lobby in the US to keep ducking, because it just keeps on coming up. And, you know, It's the same in the UK, I guess, in that Prevent has more referrals for hard-right ideology than other forms like Islamist extremism now and so on. But in the US, they've obviously got access to weaponry. And this is why this keeps happening. And, you know, being emboldened by the Proud Boys, Trumpian factions, etc., doesn't help either. So that's a really tough one to grapple with.
On another issue in America at the moment, what's happening with the debt ceiling standoff? There's a meeting with Biden and congressional leaders on Tuesday. How key is that to preventing this sort of economic meltdown, which has been forecast?
It's really a pivotal moment. So according to Janet Yellen, she's the Treasury Secretary, the US can't pay its bills. And that obviously, remember, includes all public sector wages by the 1st of June. So this is really imminent. And it's due to the nation's debt ceiling. We can call it artificial debt ceiling if you believe that. And she thinks there's no good options except raising the ceiling. But Kevin McCarthy, who's the House Speaker, is demanding spending cuts in return for agreeing to Biden raising the ceiling. So he's using that as a negotiation tactic. And Biden's furious about that. He thinks that the threat of default shouldn't be used as a form of leverage in those kind of negotiations. So they're at loggerheads. And the meeting is designed to break through that. But you know, behind McCarthy is a rump of radical Republicans who think that he should just refuse and let Biden crash and burn. even though the impact of that on the US economy would be absolutely huge and catastrophic. So the meeting is like kind of a crunch point in all of those negotiations and what comes out of it. I think it's unlikely that there'll be no impact on the economy, even if they do raise the ceiling in the short term. Now, interestingly, I read when I was researching about this is that some US economists are now saying, let's just scrap this ceiling altogether. It was created in 1917. It was useful at the time. It's outlived all usefulness now. And I think lots of us watching this spectacle might agree because, you know, this is like, public sector wages just not being paid because of a political row, basically.
Yeah, this standoff seems to happen all the time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, happened under Obama. And
so it would seem to me if there's a way to scrap it, because it's just this, you know, the adversarial way that the American system is set up, that there's always going to be someone that's a check to power but can just block things. And that is what this seems to be constantly. So, yeah, I mean, I'm no economical mega mind, but it would seem to me like there must be a better way of doing this, really.
It does feel like that.
Finally, looking to Ukraine, there seems to be a lot going on with drones at the moment. What's happening there?
So Putin's next big push has been to launch a kind of drone swarm against Ukraine. There have been four attacks in last eight days in Kyiv. You know, this is apparently ahead of an expected Ukrainian counteroffensive. So he's sort of starting a pre-attack on the offensive they're expecting from Ukraine side. The background, I suppose, is that Russian troops, together actually with a private military company they've been running as well, have been trying to capture Bakhmut for months but still haven't broken through. So it does seem to be in complete stalemate at the moment. But it does lead to the question of where this is all going to end, because it could go on for a very long time at this pace, I suppose.
Hannah, thank you for joining me for Start Your Week this morning.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoy The Bunker, remember you can support us on Patreon and get episodes early and ad-free for just £3 a month. You'll also get a shout-out on Start Your Week. Here's Hannah with today's.
Thanks so much to Hillary, Kath Moore and Simon Pritchard.
Thank you for joining us for Start Your Week. Come back tomorrow for another edition of The Bunker.
The Bunker was presented by Jacob Jarvis with Hannah Farron. The producers were Liam Tate and Kasia Tomashevich. Audio production was from me, Robin Lieber. Art by James Parrott. Managing editor, Jacob Jarvis. Group editor, Andrew Harrison. And the music is by Kenny Dickinson. And The Bunker is a Podmasters production.